A lot of people that people think are humble are not necessarily humble. Humility is not a facial expression. Humility is not rich people wearing poor folks' clothes.
Oh, hallelujah.
With secret Bentleys on other islands and places and mansions you cannot see. Don't buy into the facade of humility. Humility that we buy into is often fake humility. Humility is an inner awareness of your own frailty. It is an inner awareness of your own frailty. And if you want to increase your humility, the easiest way to increase your humility is to work on your gratitude. Gratitude, being grateful, being thankful, being appreciative. What we do as a people is that we are often overly impressed with people who look humble, only to find out that they have hidden lives of great success and they wear uniforms like actors in plays because that's what you require. I choose to be myself. Life is too short to be anybody else. I wear what I like. I eat what I like. I drive what I like. I talk to who I want to talk to. I am authentically me. But in that authenticism of being me is also an awareness that everything I have, everything I own, and everything I get to do, like being here, is such a gift from God. See, you think me coming is a gift to you, but from my perspective, me being here is a gift from God. My mother would have dreamed to stand on this stage. You were just a place she read about in a book, under a bed, raised by a sharecropper, working a field they couldn't own. When you understand that, it takes away the feeling of entitlement. You must understand humility is in the story you tell yourself about yourself. Everything that matters about you, good or bad, is a result of the narrative in your head. Check out the story you tell yourself about yourself and rebuke all of the temptations that we have to be entitled. It's about time you recognize me. You should have recognized me long time ago. Nobody has to ever recognize you. There are 8 billion people on the planet. There are 8 billion people on the planet. And that you got to be chosen is an absolute gift. And the day you stop thinking it's a gift, you lose your power to keep it going. To me, that attitude of gratitude is the substratum of humility.
How do I enhance my competence? See, let's say you want to run on the field. Let's say you want to run a race. You want to run 100 meters. It is not running that you have to work on right now. You have to work on your legs and lungs and muscle and everything, isn't it so? So, if you want to become a great engineer, yes, definitely, an institute like this is crucial on one level. But any number of people might have come here and gone, not all of them became great engineers. Though they might have produced hundreds of great engineers, still not all of them will become, simply because of their own individual attitudes and competence and whatever else, isn't it? So, whatever the institute can do for you, it is doing. One foremost thing that you need to do is to enhance your own physical and mental capabilities. Because if you want to be a good engineer, you need a working brain. Just having a degree of engineering may be a passport to a job, but it is not a passport to success, isn't it? So to have a working brain, which the engineering degree will not freeze, usually lots of degrees, when people acquire degrees, they freeze their brains. They think they can, now they have finished using it and now they can rest it for the rest of their lives. It is not so. This is only to enhance your capability. This is just an organized effort. A school, a college, an institute is just an organized effort towards that, because each individual cannot craft it for himself. That is why an institution. Otherwise, an institution has no other purpose. It is here to just organize that possibility of you striving to be of a certain competence. But that is a mass application. But as an individual, your most important thing is you as a human being, you are functioning at the fullest level. If that has to happen, there are other dimensions which one needs to explore. Unfortunately, though these sciences and technologies for inner well-being have been the mainstay of this culture for thousands of years, today we are largely losing it for various reasons, because we want to imitate somebody else. We don't want to imitate our grandfather Topi Wala anymore. We want to imitate the hat seller from another country. Because of that, we are losing those things, but we should not. We have to bring it back into our lives. This is very much a part of the way the culture itself is structured, that it is all about the human being. See, this is the only culture which talks about, which even an illiterate person in this culture is aware of, that you can actually evolve to another dimension of existence. Even if I go into a village and talk to an illiterate peasant who has not read anything, who doesn't know anything, who has not heard any of this stuff, even to him if I go, he will not ask me, give me a golden horse or something. He'll say, "Enakku mukti venum swami." He's saying he wants ultimate liberation. Where did this fellow get this? Nowhere else on the planet this is possible. Nowhere else on this planet is it possible that an illiterate person is thinking that he can break his present dimension of existence and go to another place, whatever that place is. So, this was bred into our culture so deep, we should not lose it. It was not just the idea, there are technologies to become free. If you became free from the process of your body and the process of your mind, if you can sit outside of it and work it, you would work it brilliantly, do you understand? You would be able to use this body and use this mind only when you are able to not treat it as myself. These are powerful instruments in your life. These instruments can be employed the way you want it, only when you have an outside access to it.
But when you realize that all your name, your form and everything you see is provisional, two things happen. To some people, they have immediate, what we could only metaphorically call the dark night of the soul. They go into a deep depression because everything they thought was real is no longer real, including their own name, form, body and mind. Some people get so scared that they have a bad trip. Some people cross that threshold and discover nirvana or enlightenment. And they say, "Wow, I thought I was squeezed into the volume of a body in the span of a lifetime, but I'm a timeless being that can morph myself into any experience, including the human experience, which is amazing. But the human experience is also that which causes existential depression." So the causes of human suffering, since you brought it up, are brought up in Eastern wisdom traditions as, number one, you suffer because you don't know who you are. You confuse yourself with your body-mind experience. Number two, you grasp and cling at experiences which are evanescent and transitory and dreamlike. You say, "What happened to your childhood? It's over. What happened to yesterday? It's over. What happened to 5 minutes ago? It's over. What happens to these words? By the time you hear them, they don't exist." So, you know, Wittgenstein, the German philosopher, said, "We are asleep. Our life is a dream, but once in a while we wake up enough to know that we are dreaming." So what do you wake up to? When you cross this threshold, you wake up to your true self, which is not body or mind, but the awareness in which that experience is happening. So grasping and clinging at a dream is the second cause of human suffering. The third is being afraid of anything that's unpleasant, pain. abandonment, being treated by someone not respectfully. So that's, you know, there's aversion to certain experiences. Third cause of suffering. Fourth is identifying, which is related to it, with your ego identity. And fifth is the fear of death. Now, they're all connected. They're all the same fear. And they are not knowing who you are. This is the biggest question that humans or everybody should be asking. Who am I? What am I? Am I the changing experience of this body, which is a perceptual activity? Am I the experience of the changing mind or the changing personality? Because you don't have the same personality when you were a kid or maybe even 10 years ago. What is it at the basis of this? When you start that reflective self-inquiry, ask yourself, who am I? What do I want? What is my purpose? What am I grateful for? Go into the stillness of meditation, you have what wisdom traditions have called revelation, revealed truth. Now, you know, that sounds very grand. I would say just call it insight. You know, meditation, mindfulness, awareness of body, awareness of mind, awareness of mental space, awareness of the web of relationship, awareness with that which we call the universe. It leads you ultimately to the awareness of awareness. And when you discover that, that's nirvana.
What does someone like you do to meditate? How do you meditate?
When I came to the monastery, the meditation I was taught was mantra meditation, which is chanting on beads. So I chant a mantra. And as I began the process, I realized how challenging it was to be present into the sound of the mantra and to be totally in a space, in a zone of thoughtlessness where there's nothing bothering your mind and you're completely present and listening to the sound and totally absorbed, you know, in the sound. I realized that it was a massive uphill task. And I think it comes, that the challenge comes from the fact that we've got so used to multitasking that our mind functions on 20 tracks. So when we're just on the meditation track, there are 19 other tracks to deal with. You know, you have your personal life, you have relationship issues, you have your professional issues. There's so many things going on. You have issues coming from family, so much going on in the country. There's so much that's occupying our mental space. And when you actually want to get onto the track of meditation by kind of just putting all of this in the back seat, it becomes practically impossible. And a lot of people tell me this. And when they're trying to meditate, this is what happens to them. And I share my journey with them. This is exactly what happened to me when I started. It's been 25 years now. Every single day without one day's gap, 1.5 hours every day. And I tell them that it's not a challenge today. It would be very high-headed to say that, okay, I've reached a state of enlightenment. When I sit for meditation, everything's kind of there and I'm totally absorbed. Very high-headed, I feel, to say that. But I did a few things that I feel can benefit those who want to really get into that, a deeper state of meditation. I look at meditation in two ways. A is the meditation, as in the practice. And B is everything that we do in our life as meditation, you know. And I prefer to work more on everything in my life as a meditation, which feeds into my practice of meditation.
100%. But do not neglect the practice.
Do not neglect the practice, for sure.
Yeah.
So, I'll tell you what I do, for instance. One meal a day, I just eat by myself. Two meals I take with my friends, some of my monk friends, where we discuss, chat, eat. One meal is just by myself. The reason being, I want to be present, mindful, in the moment, to savor the entire experience of touching, feeling, smelling, tasting that food. I avoid forks and spoons as much as is possible because I want to touch and feel that experience of the food. Now, the reason I do it is because it just means no phones, no books, nobody to talk to, and just being there eating. Correct? So what I'm doing is, by just eating that one meal by myself, training my mind to be in the present. Like we are talking now, there's three meetings lined up for me tonight. And there's a restaurant called Candy and Greens at Breach Candy. The family is a very close friend, you know. So they've just opened up a new rooftop terrace. been getting message after message, could you come down today evening for dinner? Right? But it's not on my mind. It's not on my mind. Nothing outside of our conversation between you and me right now is on my mind. So why do I do it? It's because right now I'm training my mind to be in the present. When I used to be in the bathroom, I would sing. Like a big thing for me used to be. Of course, earlier I would sing a lot of cinema and movie songs. And now I sing some spiritual songs, bhajans, whatever. And then one day I realized, hey, wait a minute. This is not right. Because neither am I into the singing, nor am I into the experience of bathing. Mm. So if I'm singing, I'm missing the experience of bathing. And if I'm bathing, I'm not into my singing. Mm. So why am I doing two things at the same time? I stopped singing. Just focusing on the experience of the water coming down my body and experiencing that. So to me, these little things through the day matter a lot to me. And I think that's more of meditation to me.
Mm.
Because then what I do here feeds into my mainstream practice of meditation.
Mm.
And what I do here feeds into the little things as well. So it's kind of a loop,
mm-hmm.
one feeding into other.
We are a social animal. A human being, social animal. And particularly in modern time, the reality, economy, environment, and many things heavily interdependent. That's the reality. Unlike, I think, past sort of as the ancient time. Ancient time, more or less independent, self-sufficient. They say not depend on your interest or your future, not depend on other. But now, completely change. So even from the selfish viewpoint, you have to take care about others' well-being. You just think yourself, the blind selfish. Think yourself, forget other. Or worst thing, exploit other, cheating other, bully other. Ultimately, you suffer. Through these mischievous way, you may gain some temporary sort of benefit, but in deep inside, you feel uncomfortable. Then eventually, you truly become a lonely person. Nobody loves you. Nobody respects you. If you take care of other as a human brother, sisters, sincerely, seriously, then everybody become your friend. So, when you have truly trusted friend there, if you need something, you can ask them. If you becoming friendless or lonely person, and when you really facing some problems, nobody you can share. So ultimately we are social animal. So even other animal, no law, no education, no religion, but you see, they have some kind of sort of feeling. Their own individual survival depend on rest of the community or herds. So they work together. I am one of the individual out of 7 billion human being. If human being, rest of the human being, happy, peaceful, I get maximum benefit. The rest of the world get trouble. How can I escape from that? And with that feeling, when I meet people, one person, or 10 people, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, I always consider them as my brothers, sisters. That brings me in mental level completely relaxed. If I feel I'm something different from them, then some nervousness, some anxiety may develop. So once your own way of thinking open, reach out to them as a close friend, that tremendous sort of benefit, peace of mind. Then others also feel, no longer feel stranger. Another human brothers like that. So that I think we really, nowadays, we really need that. So through that way, awareness. Then from children, I think youngsters, I think they know. They, just one child remain lonely, may cry, and play with other children. Feel very happy. So that's the human nature. So sometimes we grown up, then we always calculate if I make friendship with that, how much I get some benefit. or make friendship, then I can exploit or something. Then genuine basis of friendship no longer there, destroyed. Basis of genuine friendship is trust. Trust depend on openness. Like that. So, through these things, we can train. And then, mental level, no matter what, your physical level, busy. But mental level, always calm, restful, relax. Immense benefit for your health. So, mental health, body health, very close link. So, the ultimate source of mental health is warm-heartedness. That's my belief. Maybe wrong. My friend have to research more research work.
I decided that I wanted to not know what we know, but what is the source of knowing. Okay, it's not what you know. You know, what you know these days, you can look it up, go Google it. So, it's not important what you know. Anybody can find out anything about anything these days. You know, I can look up how many galaxies there are in the universe, or how does epigenetics work, or how does the brain function. That's not the key to creativity. To creativity and higher consciousness is how do you know what you know? What is the source of knowing and experience? What is it that knows the experience of the body? What is it that knows the experience of the mind? What is it that knows the experience called the color red? And where is that experience happening?
When you go past your ego identity, there's a bigger identity that is so huge, it's incomprehensible. It can't even be described. And there's a freedom and a joy that comes from that. And I had had glimpses of that, but this period of intense stillness. And by the way, since then, I've kept a week of silence every year. Sometimes I do more. And that week of silence, usually in September, I do every year, just to go back to the taste of timeless being.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, our ego identity, which we keep polishing every day now, especially these days with social media and books and promotions and you name it.
Reality is one wholeness. It includes all subjects, all objects, and all modes of knowing. What we have access to is a human mode of knowing. You know, in my book, Metahuman, I talk about the butterfly, the painted lady, who smells the world through her antenna. Okay. Tastes the world through her feet. Sees the world with 30,000 lenses that move like a kaleidoscope. Okay. Hears the world through her wings. What is reality to that little species? Some insects see the world 360 degrees. Okay. Because they have these what we call complex eyes with multiple lenses. You can only see within a certain range, but there are insects that can see 360 degrees. So what is reality? Reality, what we call reality, what today's science calls reality, comes under the heading of naive realism. Einstein was a naive realist. And I'm not saying this in a derogatory fashion. It's a word in the science of philosophy. Naive realism means that the physical world exists exactly as perceived by the five human senses. Now, obviously, that's not true. Other species experience the world through different modes of sensory perception. The second aspect of naive realism is that the physical world, as perceived by the five human senses, would exist even if no one was observing it. Well, how do you prove that? And firstly, it's naive because we know that the world is more than what is perceived by the five human senses. So this leads us to a solution actually of the hard problem of consciousness, which is get rid of the idea that the world is physical. What we call of the world as physical, even your physical body, is a perceptual activity. And that perceptual activity for you and me is a human perceptual activity. through human consciousness, not through bat consciousness, not through mosquito consciousness, not through plant consciousness, which would fit in with panpsychism. But non-dualism says, go beyond that. There is only one consciousness that is differentiating, you know, undifferentiated consciousness, differentiating into these different species of consciousness that form a matrix of conscious beings that are collectively projecting this universe.
Let one human being honestly say, when you are with your most loving parents, however doting and wonderful they were to you, that you never felt this is not where you want to be. That is a dishonest human being, because love gets tedious, somebody's fondness gets very tedious, comfort gets tedious, because the nature of life is it wants to constantly expand. If there is no room for expansion, it doesn't matter you are kept in a whatever, I won't use because everybody uses the word golden palace. I think golden palace is totally anesthetic in my my visual perception, I hate golden palace. But whatever is the most wonderful palace, or as you say, Shangri-La, whatever, it'll get tedious. All the heaven-bound people, they don't know how bored they will be within 3 days in that place of goodness. So I'm saying it doesn't matter. It's not because there's something wrong with your parents. They may be most wonderful people, but the very nature of a human being is such, only if you're a pet animal, if you have reduced yourself to that, you're just happy with the meals that you're getting and somebody is fondling you once in a way and you're happy with that. For that you must be a pet animal, you should not be born as a human being. Once you're born as a human being, it is natural wanting to break barriers. So when you're young as a child or a teenager, you think barriers means they're all physical. Before you understand, the barriers are not really physical. Whether you build your own house or you live in your parents' house or you live in a slave master's house, the house and walls are not the barrier. It is all within us. Before you realize that, or how soon you realize that, will lead to either transformation or frustration. I would say there's literally no human being who is not confronted with a thought and an emotion like that, but they manage to brush it aside. It doesn't bother them enough. The pain of not knowing doesn't tear them, that's the whole problem. They come to terms with ignorance, they make a deal with ignorance. They will build relationships where everybody will confirm this is the best way to live. Of comfort, companionship, love, affection. These are all things you're seeking. I know a whole lot of people have raised human emotions to heavens. If you say love, they say divine love. If you say joy, they say divine joy. If you say bliss, they say divine bliss. You don't need any God's help to be joyful, loving, peaceful. As a human being, you're endowed with these qualities. So all those who deprived themselves of that, they either seek God or they settle for a dog. Yeah, usually. Because they want a unconditional love, this is a demand. Because the nature of love is such that it's like a flower, if you don't watch it for 2 minutes, it'll fall. It'll wither and fall right there. Either you want to let it fall, or you have to nourish it every moment, or you have to concretize it. That means you take a picture and keep it on your phone screen, or you institutionalize it with marriage or this or that. So essentially, well, I'm not against any institution, because institutions are needed in the world to operate, otherwise there'll be chaos. that is a different thing. But you cannot institutionalize joy or peace, like right now we think United Nations is the institution for peace. No, no, you cannot institutionalize peace. You cannot institutionalize joy. You cannot institutionalize love or anything for that matter. Institutions are functional instruments in a given society. I have utmost respect for them because without it, people, a whole lot of people wouldn't know how to live. You need institutions, there is a government, there is a democratic process, there are a variety of things, all right? There are courts, there are parliaments. Well, 90% of the time some nonsense may be happening there, but still these institutions are important because without that there will be total chaos. So I'm not talking against institutions, but institutionalizing things that happen within a human being is a silly effort.